What I propose is that we take our lunch break when it says on the agenda we'll take our lunch break. We will move as quickly or as slowly between now and then as possible. So if we get past 3 and 3A and can start on 3B, that's fine too. So, gentlemen, take it away. No, I had turned you're on now. Your microphone is on.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. We will move on to agenda paper 3 on the proposed amendment to IC 19 and IFRIC 14. At its meeting in July 2016, the interpretation committee discussed summary of the feedback on these proposed amendments, but was not asked to make any decisions. Agenda paper 3A and 3B include our recommendation as to how to address the issues identified and ask whether you agree. Also, agenda paper 3C includes our analysis of transition requirement for first-time adapters, and the effective date. We plan to spend time before lunch discussing paper 3A, and we'll discuss paper 3B and 3C after lunch. Now, I'll hand over to Jawed, who will start our discussion on paper 3A.
Thanks. Paper 3A analyzes the feedback on the proposed amendments to IFRIC 14. These amendments address how an entity assesses the availability of a refund from a defined benefit plan when other parties can wind up the plan or affect benefits for the plan members without an entity's consent. The board proposed to amend paragraph 12 of IFRIC 14 as summarized in paragraph 5 and 6 of the paper. These amendments clarify that an entity does not have an unconditional right to a refund of a surplus if other parties could wind up a plan or use the surplus for other purposes without an entity's consent. The board viewed these powers as affecting the existence of an entity's right to a refund from a surplus. Other parties' powers to purchase annuities as plan assets or make other investment decisions without affecting the benefit for plan members would not affect the availability of a refund. The board views such powers as affecting the amount of the surplus rather than the existence of the right to the surplus itself. In addition, the board also proposed to amend paragraph 7 of IFRIC 14 to clarify that when an entity determines the availability of a refund or a reduction in future contribution, the entity takes into account any statutory requirements that are enacted or substantively enacted, as well as terms and conditions of a plan that are contractually agreed, and any constructive obligations. As we discussed briefly in July, the main issues identified related to potential inconsistencies with existing principles in IS 19 and IFRIC 14, and whether these proposed amendments reflect the economic substance of the defined benefit plans. We plan to discuss our analysis of each issue and ask if you agree with our recommendation before moving on to the next issue. So the first issue identified as issue 1 in the paper relates to potential inconsistencies with existing principles of IS 19 and IFRIC 14. Paragraph 14 on page 4 of the paper lists the main concerns identified by respondents in this area. Our analysis of these concerns is outlined in paragraph 16 to 50. On the basis of our analysis, we think the proposed amendments are consistent with IFRIC 14, and the conclusions reached by the committee and the board when developing the proposed amendments are appropriate. We would also like to emphasize that the proposed amendments clarify only the application of the asset ceiling requirements, which are separate from the determination of the defined benefit surplus or liability. Accordingly, we recommend no change to the proposed amendments to IFRIC 14 in this respect. I'd like to turn your attention to question 1 on page 13 of the paper and ask if you agree with our recommendation not to change the proposed amendments in respect of these issues and if you have any comments.
Okay, question 1 is kind of an omnibus question. So we'll address it first as the staff has raised it, and then if we need to subdivide it, we will. Comments or questions as the staff has phrased the question? Tony?
it's very similar to where I was before. I don't agree with the staff recommendation. I continue to think it's inconsistent with IFRIC 14. And I think when you said this was an omnibus question, and I think there were a lot of different questions raised in this area. My sense is that they were all asked differently, but they all circled around the same issue, which is whether the existence of an unconditional right to the surplus focuses on the existence of the right, or is it something that addresses the amount or the ability to control the amount of the surplus that that right provides an entitlement to? And my sense is that's the question that a lot of people have raised. And given the number of people that raised it, my sense is that it's probably worthy of a further debate. My sense of the guidance is that IFRIC 14 says the refund's available if the entity has an unconditional right. It then clarifies in the basis for conclusions that there isn't an unconditional right if the right depends on actions by a third party. And my sense is that if a company has a right to a refund for whatever is left over, that right is enforceable irrespective of the actions of other people, then it has an unconditional right. The amount might change. The amount might change as a result of the actions of the entity to give something away, or the actions of the trustees to enhance the benefits or buy an annuity, changes in markets, changes in legislation, changes in demographics. All of those things might affect the amount of any refund, but I still look at what IFRIC 14 says as saying, does the entity have an unconditional right to the piece that is left over? So after the liabilities have been settled, whether that's in runoff or wind-up or whatever, does the entity have an unconditional right to what's left over? And I think that's a separate question from the measurement of the amount of the surplus, whatever it might be at the time that that right comes into effect. So I disagree with the draft interpretation before it was issued, and I'm in the same place. My sense is that quite a lot of people have raised that question. They may have phrased it in different ways and come at it differently, but I do think that is the key question. And I do think we need to have another debate about whether the issue here is an unconditional right or is it affecting the amount. And I don't think that being able to affect the amount calls into question the existence of an unconditional right. Having said that, if the committee ends up in a position it was before, supporting draft interpretation, I'm still not clear why the power of a third party to enhance the benefits, which is the defined benefit obligation, is one part of any surplus, affects the existence of the right to the surplus, but the ability to affect the measurement of plan assets, which is another part of determining how much is available, does not affect the existence of an unconditional right. I can't see any difference between the two, and if we want to create that as a rule, then we need to explain effectively that that's what we're doing.
As the man said, we will put you down as undecided.
Yep.
Other comments? Yamsu?
Actually, I support the staff analysis conclusion. What the staff is trying to explain is the difference between the control of the plant assets and control of the refund. And this interpretation, what we are trying to say is the control of the refund, not about the control of the plant asset. To me, plant asset can be changed any time in the future. But what we are talking about is the right about the amount at the reporting date, and whether the entity has the unconditional right unto that. So that I think those two are very different. So I fully support the analysis and the conclusion of the staff.
John?
I mean, I haven't changed my position on this draft interpretation. I think it's confusing the measurement of the right with the existence of the right, and I don't think that the power of the trustee to either enhance the benefits or to invest the assets in the future affects the existence of the right to the refund at balance date. So I'm in exactly the same place as Tony is, for exactly the same reasons that he actually set out. I think draft interpretation is confusing the existence of the right with the with what that right is to, which I think is that doesn't affect its existence. So I have the same concerns. I also share his concerns about why the trustee's powers to enhance the benefits is somehow different than the trustee's powers to invest the assets. Because if one actually affects, if we believe one affects the existence of the right, then I don't see why the other one doesn't affect the existence of the right. So I have exactly the same concerns about the draft interpretation as Tony expressed.
Carl?
Thanks. One step back. I'm not that comfortable with the level of to go ahead as it is with the level of comments against the interpretation. We have several. Comments are 50-50 in general. We don't have a overwhelming support to go ahead as it is, and I'm beforehand uncomfortable to simply move on and with minor changes. I agree. In general, I agree with the changes itself, but the quantity of comments against the draft makes me concerned about going ahead as it is.
Mary?
A question that I have, I guess it's for both Tom and John, but I'll direct it at, sorry, for Tony and John, I'll direct it at Tony, who's the first one to raise it. In your expression of concern, let me focus on the first point you made about distinguishing the unconditional right to the surplus from the ability to control the amount of the surplus and whether there's consistency, whether that has been approached correctly in this interpretation. I'd like you to think about something. I'm going to set a ground rule that is you can't quarrel with what's in IFRIC 14 already, just with the proposed addition changes to that. If an entity has an unconditional right to a surplus on wind-up, okay, but the trustees have the ability to put the plan into wind-up, and let's say that's the basis on which you are assessing control of the asset, the surplus that exists today. I think what you are saying is focus on whether or not you have that right, not how the measurement of that may change by the actual effect of wind-up. If I look, however, at IFRIC 14, and I look at paragraph, I think it's 14 of IFRIC 14, so it's that fatal 14-14 combination, it says, in measuring the amount of a refund available, consider costs that would be incurred, including insurance premiums. So if you have assessed the trustees have the right, but if they put it into, if they put it into wind-up, then when they put it into wind-up, the measurement of the refund has to be net of both professional fees and insurance premiums, which would include presumably the estimate of settlement costs. Doesn't that run counter to your analysis? You could argue or not with whether IFRIC 14 is consistent, but I put that off limits.
No, I don't think it does, because I think what we're focusing on, and maybe John articulated better than I did, is the difference between the existence and the measurement of it. If an entity has an unconditional right to whatever is left over, then there might be a separate question about how you measure it. But I still think there is an unconditional right if the entity is able to enforce its right to whatever is left over. I don't know, John, is that... I think that's the point we were both trying to make.
And attaching a simple numerical example to that, if the amount of the surplus is 100, and you say, well, if the trustees wind up, I would have right to any surplus that remains after wind up, would you say that demonstrates my control of 100, or would you say that demonstrates control of what I think would be the surplus? You know, after allowing for those costs and... Sorry, this is not a quiz for which there's a right answer and you'll be... I wanted to ask you, which... Does it say you're done and dusted and you have demonstrated control of 100? Or does it say you've demonstrated that there's some control and now I must measure it on that basis?
I would say I've demonstrated control, and then I've got to think about measuring it, and I'd want to think a bit more about how I would come at the measurement question. But to me, what I was trying to focus on is the existence of an unconditional right to the surplus as being a question that is distinct from the measurement of that surplus and events in the future that can affect the measurement of that surplus. So the fact that things can happen in the future, that means maybe when the plan is wound up or run off, in fact, there isn't a surplus, doesn't, to me, alter the existence of an unconditional right to whatever that surplus might be.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I would differentiate, for example, between if I had a right to a surplus, but actually it was conditional upon the trustee approving it. That's not an unconditional right to a surplus. But if I have a right to a surplus that has no conditions attached, but the trustee can do things which affect that surplus in the future, to me that is unconditional. I have an unconditional right. The fact they can do things which affect the quantum of that surplus doesn't have anything to do with the existence of that right.
Could I just ask a question? I'm not quite sure, Tony, where your view... I can see that maybe we could articulate the requirements or the proposals more clearly, but I'm not quite sure that your view gets to a different answer, because I think what the proposals say is that, I mean, you've got a surplus. You think about whether you have a right to that surplus. We say that if the trustees have the right to increase the benefits, that means... that you don't have a right to that surplus because it might be used to increase the quantum of the benefits. If the trustees have the right to wind up the plan, then, and I would agree that then becomes more a question of measurement, but I think where the proposals get you to is that you would say, okay, well, if the cost of winding up the plan is going to be whatever, and there's this bit left, then that is the bit that I would then recognize as my asset, which I think is what, is that not what you're saying you want to get to? So I, although we might be disagreeing about how to express it, I'm not sure that we're getting to different answers.
I think we are, because I would look at the trustee's decision to enhance benefits as something that happens in the future and doesn't affect the measurement today. I would look at the rules as they are today. I wouldn't consider changes in the rules in the future.
So you wouldn't... So of sort of all the circumstances that we're considering, which is sort of increasing benefits or winding up, you wouldn't take account of any of those in determining...
But I think what I'm saying is that I would look at the rules of the plan, the benefits of the plan as they are today. And I'd say that things like changes in benefits as a result of the trustee's action, or changes in the market value of investments or changes in the plan assets are all things that happen in the future and are not relevant to the assessment today of the right to a refund of the surplus as it's sitting there at the moment.
I think the difference the committee saw when it developed the proposals, especially in the case of enhancing the benefits, they saw it more as a case of where if an entity were to approach the trustees to say hand over the surplus, the trustees could just refuse and say we're going to use it to enhance the benefits. And I think that's where the committee said an entity does not have an unconditional right to get the refund because the trustees can just deny them that refund.
I think that's probably where our difference is. If the trustees, I think John just said this, if the trustees have the right to say you can't have a refund, then we would be all in the same place. If any refund had to be approved.
Yes.
But if the rules are explicit that once the plan is run off, I'll use the example of a runoff, but whatever's left over, there is an unconditional enforceable right to that amount, then I think there is an unconditional right to a surplus. And the fact that the amount of that surplus might change in the future doesn't affect the existence of that right today.
Mary?
Tony, going back to Anne's question, but also following up on Jevitt's challenge to you, and I'll attach my numbers to her example. There's a surplus of 100. The trustees have not decided to wind up the plan. If they decided to wind up the plan, the estimate is that the costs, et cetera, that are discussed in paragraph 14 would consume 80 of that surplus. In that scenario, just looking at, let's say refund is the only way that you could get something. In that scenario, would you say I have a right to 100 or I have a right to 20? Sorry, it's saying, yeah. I'm for the minute accepting your position that that your right to a refund that's in the plan documents demonstrates that you have control of the surplus, and so therefore you're going on to the step of measuring the mm-hmm. amount, and I'm assuming that there's a measurement that's an overlay to the surplus calculated at that date. Would you say, asset of 20 or asset of 100? You're saying the plan terms demonstrate that you have a right to anything remaining on wind up.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I think you'd say 20.
Yeah, I think I probably would, but again, I'm going to reserve.
Yeah.
It's not having thought through issues of the arithmetic. Yeah.
But ahead. So that's kind of measurement, control, measurement is the three steps there. Contrast that, and I think this is what Javed was saying, is if there's an asset of 100, and the trustees can at any time unilaterally decide to increase benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that challenge your assertion that you control that 100 today? Because somebody can step in and take it away at any point, even if they haven't done so.
I don't think it does, because the unconditional right to the surplus continues to exist. And so I think that's just a difference between the way that we've been looking at it.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to open it up for others.
Yeah.
I mean, I think... I consider the asset to be the right. I don't consider the asset to be the surplus. There's a surplus in the plan, but the asset that's recognized is not the surplus. It's actually the right to the surplus. And I think you do have that right. It's unconditional. And then there's a question of measurement. I think to answer Mary's question, I think paragraph 14 of IFRIC 14 would tell you to take the 100 and take off settlement costs and insurance premiums. So that's a measurement issue for how you'd recognize it. But I don't think your right doesn't exist. Just because of the power of the trustee to do things in the future which affect the quantum of the amount. Because your asset's not the surplus, your asset is the right to the surplus.
Bertrand?
Yeah, I'm not a specialist because I'm not an Anglo-Saxon, so we don't have in our countries such complex questions. But on this, I would just to make sure I understand the point there. Applying IAS 19, I have to net my plan assets and my defined benefit obligation. So I fair value my plan assets at the end of 2016, let's say, and then I value my defined benefit obligation on an ongoing basis. We are not talking about a wind up, which would mean a debt buyout and a fair value. So we are not in this situation. We are just on an ongoing basis, and we value the benefit obligation using the project credit unit method. So it's not a fair value. And then I have to net. So generally, my DBO is above the fair value of plan assets. I recognize the liability on my balance sheet. Then the question is when my fair value of plan asset exceeds my defined benefit obligation. What do I do? Am I allowed to account for a financial asset on my balance sheet? Then to answer this question, I look at the deeds and rules of the plan. And if the deeds and rule of the plan states any potential surplus at the end, not necessarily in the context of a wind-up, but if any surplus at the end of the life of the plan is reverted back to the beneficiaries of the plan, then I don't recognize any financial asset, and I would account for a provision just to write off the financial asset from my balance sheet. On the contrary, if my deeds and rules state that any surplus at the end of the life of the plan, not necessarily in the context of a wind-up, states that any potential surplus revert back to the principal employer of the plan, then I account for the financial asset. And it's quite a binary question. It's do I account for a financial asset, yes or no, on an ongoing basis? And then if I say I recognize that, it's generally because deeds and rules state that it's not generally just trustees, as far as I understand it. Huh? I'm not a specialist of that, but I work a bit on such issues, but from the outside, let's say. So generally, it's not the trustees alone that decide. It's the trustees and the principal employer that needs to negotiate, as they do during the triennial funding evaluation process in the UK, to reach a consensus on what should be the minimum funding requirements for the next 3 years. So there I can understand. And then I have no problem with the agenda paper written by the staff, because I don't think it contradicts anything with that. But are we discussing this, or are we discussing something else, which I don't know what it is, honestly. And you can just analyze such an issue using the wind-up, which is quite a complex process. You first have a buy-in, then a buy-out, and then buy-out doesn't mean necessarily that you would trigger wind-up. So wind-up is very specific. And what about a regular case? What is the situation in a very regular case? I have the fair value of plan assets that exceeds the defined benefit obligation at the end of the balance sheet, and my deeds and rules of the plan state that the principal employer is eligible to any surplus attached to this. So then I would say I recognize the financial assets, depending on the other conditions that are within IFRIC 14. But if effectively nothing within IFRIC 14 contradicts the fact that I'm eligible to receive this surplus, I would tend to think that I would recognize the financial asset on my balance sheet.
Let me see if I can experiment and either demonstrate that I understand or that I'm a fool. Conceptually, we run into this when we do concepts work. We say, does this meet the definition of an asset? If it doesn't meet the definition of an asset, then the measurement is irrelevant because it ain't mine, so I got zero. In consolidations, we took it a little farther and we said, well, does it have control? And I think, Sue, that we said control is unitary. If I got it, you don't. So control cannot be shared, and we introduced that notion. I think when I hear John and Tony and Carl's kind of in there to some degree, are saying that's the fundamental debate. Does the power of the trustee invalidate whether or not you've got an asset? If the answer to that is yes, then we don't have a measurement issue to talk about.
I was going to say something very similar.
So, yeah,
I'm not an IFRIC 14 specialist by any stretch of the imagination, so I have to go back to concepts here. And the thing I struggle with and why I think the outcome is appropriate is that I just can't see that there's control over future economic benefits. If the trustee has the ability to turn around and say, actually, you're not going to get it, I've decided these guys are going to get it.
So you're focused on the enhanced benefits?
Yes, I don't think you have an unconditional right to, because the whole right can be handed off to somebody else. And I can't stop it.
Okay.
In the example I was quoting, the financial asset you would recognize, generally it's why? It's because it will be, let's say, used by the company, the principal employer, to fund future contributions to the plan. And honestly, then, if it's the case, the question would be merely what is at the end of the plan? Does the principal employer or the beneficiaries have the right to any potential theoretical surplus at the end of the life of the plan? But then if at a certain point in the middle of the duration of the plan I have in accounting a potential surplus of the fair value of plan assets over my defined benefit obligation, the mere question is more, will I be in a position as a principal employer to use this surplus to finance, like an advance on future contribution payments within the minimum funding requirements?
Could I just try and run through the different scenarios? If under IFRIC 14, there's two ways that you can identify that you might have an asset. One is whether you get a refund, and one is whether you can get reductions in future contributions. If you can get reductions in future contributions, that's not the bit of IFRIC 14 that we're addressing in these amendments. So we can sort of put that to one side. So this is just talking about can you get a refund? And the first thing is, yes, do you have an unconditional right to a refund? And the proposals are saying that you don't have an unconditional right to the refund if the trustees can do something else. And focusing on the first something else, which is they might be able to enhance the benefits of the employees. So they can use the surplus to enhance the benefits of the employees. And the proposals say that means that the company does not have an unconditional right to benefit from the surplus itself. So we wouldn't recognize an asset. It then goes on to think about, and this is where it does, I can understand where people get confused about the recognition and the measurement, because it then goes on to talk about do the trustees have a right to wind up the plan? And at that point, in an ideal world, if the measurement under IAS 19 was perfect, the right to wind up a plan wouldn't affect the measurement, because you know you've got a surplus on an IAS 19 basis. When you wind up the plan, that surplus is what's left if we had ideal measurement. yes, I know, it's an amusing idea. But you'd have the right to what was left on a wind-up, and that would be the amount of the surplus that we'd measured under IAS 19, and we wouldn't have any of these discussions. So the discussions arise because of problems to do with measurement in IAS 19. So the proposals say, well, okay, if you have a right to a surplus, but the trustees have the right to wind up the plan, then in measuring your rights, you have to take into account the fact that the trustees might wind up the plan and take into the cost, take into account the costs of doing that. So that is saying you have the right, but you need to take into account the fact that actually the measurement of IS 19 isn't perfect and you need to factor in these costs. And then the bit then...
Do you mean that we are dealing with there is the conflict between the way the defined benefit obligation is measured using the projected unit credit method on an ongoing basis on one hand, and the fact that you would fair value your liability, your pension liability, using a debt buyout, a debt which is far above depending on the types of population which benefits from effectively the plan.
Yes.
And then, okay, understand.
And then the final thing that the proposals considered was whether the fact that the next thing that the trustees might be able to do without the company stopping them is that they might be able to have a different asset investment within the plan. And again, ideally, that wouldn't affect the measurement of the measurement of the plan liabilities because you're just changing the assets within the plan. Ideally, it wouldn't affect the measurement of the plan assets because everything ideally would be measured at fair value, just be swapping assets. It wouldn't make a difference. It does make a difference, unfortunately, because under IS 19, if you buy insurance policies, if you buy in insurance policies to the plan, then they are measured at the same value as the plan liabilities that they cover, that they exactly match. So in that circumstance, if you bought in these annuities, you would end up with a loss. And the conflict that I do see exists is that we say, so if the trustees can enhance the benefits, we say, okay, that means you haven't got a right. If the trustees can wind up the plan, we say, okay, you've got a right, but you need to measure it, taking into account the potential costs of wind up. If the trustees have the right to a different asset allocation, we say you don't take that into account. And I mean, you sort of have to draw the line somewhere, and that's where these proposals draw the line. But it does, I'm not going to pretend there isn't a sort of unfortunate inconsistency there. But anyway, so that's how the proposals are structured. I don't know if that helps in
seeing what's... So we're in the case, a very specific case of a buyout.
Well...
Which means... then fair value the pension liabilities.
No.
It's only one of the cases.
Yeah. One of the three possibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the two others then?
Enhancing the benefits. So if the trustees can enhance the benefits, we say you don't, that the company doesn't have a right to the service.
But do you have cases? It's where I don't know the pension sufficiently enough, the UK pension regulation, but can the trustees alone decide in many cases? Because I would most think that it's a negotiation between the trustees and the principal employer. Generally, the Ditton's rule do not allow the trustees alone to decide.
My understanding was that was the fact pattern that prompted the question being brought.
Initially, the question was brought.
Alfred did indicate that does exist in some jurisdictions, in some plans.
Okay, let's get some other people involved here. Thank you for that.
And sorry, the third case?
So the first case was enhancing the benefits, second case is winding up the plan, and the third case is changing the asset allocation, changing the investment policy of the plan. And there we say, I mean, ideally it wouldn't make any difference. In fact, it will, but we are not going to anticipate that in measuring the asset that you get from the
And surplus. Presumably the logic there is you still have the right to something, the something just changes.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, we've got other people who've been waiting very patiently. So Martin, and then somebody down there in the corner, either Bob or Jim, and Reinhardt.
I mean, the discussion sometimes remind me a little bit on an escrow account, because I agree with another party to do something. I put money in an escrow account, and then we try to do the best for both, so to say. However, with regard to that escrow account, I need the agreement of two then later on to get the money out of the escrow account. So therefore, I still would be able to account for that money. Yeah, if I put something on an escrow account, I could account for that as an asset. In that case, as far as my understanding of the case here, the trustees have the sole right to increase the benefits for probably inactive employees or whatever. So I have no benefit at all out of that decision. So therefore, I have no unconditional right to any surplus. I have no possibility to influence what is done with that resource, so to say, and therefore I believe our outcome is we would not account for that, and I would agree on that.
Okay. Bob?
I would agree with Tony and John on a conceptual basis. If we looked at this in a normal basis, so looking at the plan assets and the obligation as separate units, the trustee's ability to increase the obligation has no effect on my right to the assets. If this was a nuclear decommissioning fund and obligation, the government's right to change my obligation has no effect on how my rights or my measurement of the assets. My problem is, I feel like Mary said at the beginning, you know, our hands are tied. I have to play by the rules that exist under IS 19 and IFRIC 14, and it says I've got to look at these together.
Yeah.
And having to look at them together, I think my hands then are tied, and I then say, well, okay, yeah, they don't affect the assets, they affect the obligation, but because the obligation is tied to the assets, then the trustees can take away that surplus, and I don't have a right to it.
Reinhardt?
I agree with the staff proposals, and I think Anne said it very articulately in terms of the conflict that exists on the asset side, but I think part of the issue we're struggling with is that the surplus is a net number. It's the net of the assets and liabilities. And so I think, as someone indicated, if from the perspective of the sponsor of the plan, my right to an asset is impaired if somebody else can take that asset away from me, and the way they can take it away from me is if they enhance benefits. And so I think that's, when I look at my right to an asset itself, I don't see how you can have an asset for that net number if somebody can reduce the net number to zero. I agree that there may be instances on the asset side where where the trustees could do something that would essentially make it zero. Yeah. But and maybe there's a conflict there, but I think I kind of distinguish that situation, because to me the more obvious or relevant situation is if I don't have an asset in the first place, being somebody else has a control over that net number.
Young Soo?
I just want to say that, you know, the what the interpretation is trying to say is not about measurement, it's about recognition. And what the interpretation is trying to say to me is that the recognition should depend upon who has the right. So if I go back to Mary's, you know, the example, there's the $100 of surplus. But if somebody has $80 amount of right, then I have only 20. So what it simply says is that whether I have the right onto the amount or not, if I don't have any right, that's not my asset. So, you know, to me, this interpretation is so simple. Who has the right? Who don't have that right? That's about it.
Okay, I'm going to try and call the question on this one. I heard, if my hearing is correct, kind of this end of the table down here.
We want to get invited back.
Pardon me? Well, John has already said he's going to leave here anyways. But with regard to question one, Any other objections to the staff recommendations? All right, they'll proceed as drafted then. Let's go.
I'm not going to argue about it again. Make one observation, which is I think we need to explain why we get a different answer for the ability to go invest the funds in something else. Because we've all said that there is an inconsistency. So if we're going to go with this, I think we need to be clear about why we've decided to put the line where we've put it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that the answer isn't because we said so. as it often is in line drawing exercises. All right, we got 10 minutes before I promised to give people a break for lunch. So let's try with issue two.
Now, we will now move to second issue, issue two. Some respondents say that the application of the proposed amendment does not reflect the economic substance of a defined benefit plan. Paragraph 51 summarizes the concerns raised by these respondents. Our analysis of these concerns is outlined in paragraph 53 to 59 of this paper. On the basis of our analysis, we recommend no change to the proposed amendment, IFRIC 14, in this respect. I would like to turn your attention to question 2 on page 16 and ask if you agree with our recommendation not to change the proposed amendment in respect of issue 2-1 to 2-3, and if you have any comment. Thank you.
Okay, we've walked over this ground a little bit already. And Sandy, I didn't even ask you though on the previous one, so I'll ask you to go first on this one. Evidently, we've lost Sandy. Okay. Any additional comments on question two? All right, we'll go with it. Issue three?
Okay. We will move on to issue three, which related to some of the other substantive issues identified by respondents. Paragraph 60 lists those concerns. For issue 3-1, we agree with some respondents who say that the proposed amendment to IFRIC 14 do not adequately clarify the distinction between the purchase of annuities as plan assets and the purchase of assets as part of a wind-up of a plan. We also understand the respondents' concern with the use of the term wind-up of the plan. As outlined in paragraph 71, we recommend amending the wording in paragraph 12A of IFRIC 14 to refer to other parties' power to use a surplus to settle in full and plan liabilities rather than referring to their powers to wind up a plan. Our analysis of issue 3-2 and 3-3 is presented in paragraph 72 to 80 of this paper. We recommend no change to the proposed amendment to IFRIC 14 in respect of these issues. Now, I would like to direct your attention to question 3A and 3B on page 20. For question 3A, I would like to ask if you agree with our recommendation to amend the wording in proposed paragraph 12A of IFRIC 14. For question 3B, I would like to ask if you agree with our recommendation not to amend the proposed amendment IFRIC 14 in respect of issue 3-2 and 3-3. Now I will hand over to you before moving on to question 4. Thank you.
I'd like to direct our attention first to paragraph 71. This is the proposed change. Comments on that staff recommendation. Obviously, keeping you from lunch is an incentive. Mary?
I had just a brief comment I wanted to mention so it wasn't a surprise in drafting, which is I'd ask the staff to consider whether the qualifier of in full is necessary or even appropriate. I don't expect them to answer at the table, but just wanted them to think about whether it's just the ability to settle, period.
Point taken. Anybody else on that paragraph? Andrew?
Just to echo Mary's point, the thing that occurred to me is if we have in full in there, are we setting a bright line? And what happens if I do a 99.9% settlement? Does that take me out?
Okay. All right, we'll take that as given. The other staff recommendations are to not make no changes. So that would be 3B. Bob? Tony?
Yeah, just I've not been back to actually look at the detailed words, but just looking at issue 3.2, where it says if really asking the question, what's the implications of decisions that are taken jointly? And the implication of what's written in paragraph 74 is that there wouldn't be an unconditional right if decisions are taken jointly. But if you think about the way that the notion of joint is considered in the context of joint control, that means that decisions have to be approved by both parties. So if we're in a position where the entity would be able to block the trustees being able to wind it up and put it in runoff, then you could say, well, there is an unconditional right because I can let it go into runoff and I can prevent the trustees putting it in wind-up. And so I'm not sure if there are plans to be any words, but if there are, I just think we need to be careful how we use the word joint or jointly.
Point taken. That moves us to question 4.
Finally, for question 4 on page 20, I would like to ask if you have any comments on and if you agree with staff recommendation on the other issues outlined in Appendix A to this paper.
Lonnie?
Yeah, I had just a couple of comments. There aren't numbers. So the first one on page 23, where the staff is suggesting to include examples of other parties that an entity might consider. So it's a similar comment that I made before. As long as this is not an inclusive list, I always get a little worried about putting in examples. We just have to take care with the wording. Then the issue that starts on page 24 and continues on page 25, just a couple of comments. Let's see, at the top of page 25 in the first full paragraph, the second sentence where it says, however, as explained in paragraph BC7 of the EB, the phrase substantively enacted in the proposed amendments to paragraph 7 of IFRIC 14 is intended to refer to the statutory requirements. Is this something that we should add to the basis of conclusions to clarify that point, or is that clear somewhere else? Or is that what the staff was suggesting to do?
Well, we think it's already in the basis of conclusion in BC8, but I think we'll be careful in how we word in the final drafting to make sure that it comes out very clearly that substantively enacted only applies to statutory obligation.
And then further down where it's talking about paragraph 5, and there's some discussion about constructive obligations. Is there some need to add some wording to clarify that includes constructive obligations, or we think that's already clear?
Our view is that it is clear that constructive obligations are included, just given the wording in paragraph 5 and then how it's explained further as well. So our recommendation is not to add anything further to clarify constructive obligations.
That's it. Thanks.
Okay. All right. I think the staff has sufficient guidance. We'll break for lunch. Believe it or not, that was the easy part.